Hey, everybody. On this episode of the Comic Book Exchange, we're getting up close and personal with author Maragrid Scott. Let's do this.
This is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Comic Book Exchange here on Book Circle Online. This is the show that goes in-depth in comic books, talking about comic book series and the people that make them. I'm one of your hosts, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter, at HappyGoJackie. Over here on the left, we've got Charming and Dashing, Lex Michael.
Charming and Dashing.
Charming and Dashing.
I leveled up. Hi, I am Lex Michael, all over social media, at the Lex Michael. And I'm also here with...
Hi, guys. I'm Joelle Monique, and you can find me everywhere, at Joelle Monique.
And our fourth of the panel, Lucretia Lyons, she is on assignment, as we like to say in the business. So she will be back with us next week. But this week, we are here all talking about Maragrid Scott. She is an author that's worked on in both an animation and comics. You've seen her work on Guardians of the Galaxy, Spider-Man Web Warriors, Avengers Assemble. In comic books, she's worked on the Transformers series. Her latest series, though, is a collection of her series from Archaea Press, Toil and Trouble, based on the kind of her version of an alternate take of the Hamlet Hamlet. I've already failed on my Shakespeare knowledge. Macbeth. Look at that.
Right into the tree.
I'm holding this copy of this freshly new book that's going to be coming out shortly, and at the end of the show, we're going to show you how you can get a chance to win this very copy. America's even probably an autograph it, write something witty. Something really cool. Maybe she'll draw like a nice caricature of something. No, I'm promising way too much.
Not a nice caricature.
Ladies and gentlemen, Maragrid Scott.
Hi, everyone.
Yay.
All right. So let's just jump right into this here with you. So your whole career, now you got your start first as a writer in animation and then made the transition to comics? Or
yeah, I got my start on writing the TV show Transformers Prime, which was a really messed up version of Transformers.
What, messed up how?
Well, we really like to focus on the fact that it was a war, and so like we were kind of dark and gritty, and we like pushed some boundaries, and some of my episodes are kind of infamous, so like
fun, go find them.
Yeah so yeah, like we there's I think probably the most infamous I ever did was I did an episode called Hurt, which was like there's one of the characters, it's like a 14-year-old girl, and she's paired up with the SUV robot, and he gets shot in the spine, and so she teams up with his war buddy, and she kills the guy that shot him.
What?
It's like a true grit episode. And then she realizes that, you know, revenge doesn't actually help anything at the end. Like, that was our moral lesson. But yeah.
And they also turn into trucks.
Yeah, they also turn into trucks.
That's dope, dude.
This is amazing.
No, but that's like all my favorite episodes of, like, you know, the Batman the Animated Series,
exactly.
Or Gargoyles. Like, from a young age, were like the super gritty, like, I can't believe they allowed that. Like, the Joker just leaving, like, people paralyzed and just smiles, like, frozen.
Yep.
Like, so much scarier than a gun. Or, like, I just, when Batman has to sit with a girl as she's dying on a swing set, and just sits there and just holds her hand. Like, that's so dark and, like, depressing, and it shouldn't be for kids, but that's the most fun stuff. I gotta go watch it. I haven't watched, like, a lot of Transformers cartoons since, like, the 80s version.
Well, if you like things really dark, Transformers Prime is probably one of the darkest versions of Transformers that has ever been put on television. And they also did Rescue Bots, which is one of the lightest.
So, range, demonstrating some range?
Yeah. That's been really fun, like, working on one brand over multiple, like, platforms and, like, different age ranges, you know, trying to figure it out. Although there was a point in time where I was doing the Transformers comic and the Transformers TV show, and they had a lot of the same characters, but they had really different characterizations, and it was just really confusing to try and keep everyone straight in my head.
How did you manage to do it?
Just a lot. I actually, like, built, like, a cheat sheet of, like, phrases, you know, just, like, get the right voices in my head. So it's, each character sort of got, like, a couple of lines that were, like, okay, no, that's how they sound, you know, and then...
That's a really awesome, like, fast, quick cheat sheet. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's been really fun.
Now, you also worked on G.I. Joe Renegades as well.
Yeah, I worked production on G.I. Joe. I never got the chance to write it because it didn't get renewed.
And I've listened to various podcasts like War Rocket Ajax.
Yes.
You're talking with Chris Sims there talking about the infamous Nerf gun battles that you folks would have there.
Yes! Oh my god, those were so good. Okay, so, G.I. Joe was a sister show to Transformers. They had, like, the same a couple of the same heads, and so the productions worked in the same office. And Hasbro decided, since they just started up the studio, they were going to give us all Nerf guns, which is a terrible idea. And like every now and then, the G.I. Joe team would just, like, the office would get like weirdly quiet, and then you'd realize that like the G.I. Joe team wasn't at their desk. And then they would leap out and like shoot a bunch of Nerf guns at the Transformers team. And but like after the first one, we like caught on, and so like people like started, like people had like Nerf guns like taped under their desk, like ready. And it was really fun because like there were like three people. There was like me, the casting person, and one other person that worked on both shows, so no one ever knew whether or not to shoot us. And there was like a great thing where one of the I remember like sneaking up behind one of the production coordinators on G.I. Joe, and he's like, I'm like, no, don't worry, I'm on your side. And he had like a Nerf sword, and then I just like shot him in the back of the head. Just completely double agented it.
I imagine you'd get to a point where at the just any sound, somebody would start firing a foam dart. And we're like, I'm imagining like the control room at the end of Winter Soldier, but with foam darts flying everywhere.
It was actually, there was one really, because at some point, someone invested in a Gatling gun. Like a Nerf Gatling gun.
Oh my God.
It's like, that was like set up, and of course it was on the honor system how many bullets you thought you could take. But yeah, I remember there was like after one battle, there was just like, it was just littered, you know, like with Nerf bullets everywhere.
Nerf shells all over the ground. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It was awesome.
Have you seen the atomic bomb of Nerf?
No.
There's literally like it's like dome shaped, and there's a bunch of like Nerf pieces in there, and you can like pull a thing and it's all over the room.
And then it's like, I guess everyone in the room is like, oh, I'm hitting it.
We all died.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I would love like a Nerf grenade.
Yes. Like,
although it'd be one, so I guess production-wise, it's not practical.
What if it was, like, hollow and then release, like, a lot of things, like, when it hits something?
Yeah. You would have to be, like, you know, like, maybe it releases, like, little, like, couches or something. little pellets.
Little couches. That's my nickname in a lot of circles, little couches.
Yeah, couches sounds delightful.
Yeah, when I DJ. Yeah. I'm DJ Little Couches.
So you're working in television, and then the opportunity to write comic books come along. Were you a big fan of comic books growing up?
Yeah, well, I had the thing where I grew up with a lot of television based on comic books. So I grew up with like 90s X-Men and Batman the Animated Series and stuff. But it was a little bit hard to get into comic books because, like, I remember over the summer I was like, oh, I'm gonna try and read an X-Men book, and I went down to my comic book store and it was like X-Men 347, and like I didn't get that they came out every month, and that was just kind of confusing for me. But when I was in high school, Marvel started their Ultimates line.
Okay.
And that got me in, so good job, Marvel. That absolutely worked the way that you wanted it to, you know?
Well, because I feel like so many people have different opinions about coming into a series. Some people love the idea of coming in at issue like 314 of a series and knowing that there's this big history and they're excited about that. And other people feel just overwhelmed, like, oh, there's 314 other issues. I'm coming in like somewhere in the storyline. I don't know where to go. But the Ultimates, when they kind of do their old reboot, good way for everybody to kind of join in right at the beginning.
Yeah, well, especially too, because remember, that was really before you could get comics on the internet at all. So, like, if you, like, back issues were real dicey in terms of being able to procure them. So, like, as someone who was new to the genre, that was just a really great way for me to start reading comics and feel like I got my footing. And then, so yeah, I started reading comics in high school and then just have kept going ever since then.
So when this opportunity comes to write various comic series that you're doing, was it an easy adaptation to jump from working in animation to comic books, or is it a little of a challenge to kind of do a different structure of writing?
It's definitely a challenge. The one thing I had going for me was that my first book was supposed to tie in the TV show I was working on one of the movies. So we had to like explain some... Oh, no, it wasn't. Sorry. It was tying in the TV show to something that, like, something else we had to tie into. I forgot. Maybe it was the movies. It was a while ago. It was a good book, though. But, like, I knew the subject matter, and I knew, like, everyone's voices, and so I felt very comfortable in the world. So the only hurdle was switching over to formatting. But the formatting is really different, and it gets really... it is kind of a tough thing to, like, adjust that pacing of, like, what makes a solid comic book story versus a solid episode of television, you know? And I always like to say, like, in television, you might have, like, a two-page fight sequence. And but in comics, you have to decide, like, what are the six images that make you feel like you just watched a two-page fight.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, that's definitely a hurdle. And, like, actually, it's funny because IDW, while I was writing Transformers Windblade Volume 2, they dropped from 22 pages to 20 pages. And, like, that just messed up my pacing for a long time. Like, just having to, like, just losing two pages was just freaked me out as a writer for a while.
I have to imagine, because as a reader, you're like, well, you're always kind of bummed when you, the page count drops on something. But it's like, well, two pages doesn't seem so much. But as a writer, or even an artist, just pacing has got to be just such an adjustment to make when you lose that kind of two pages of real estate.
Yeah, you don't notice it. But, yeah, and the nice thing, though, is I feel like I've grown a lot as a writer, so now I'm used to, like, okay, how many pages do I have to work with? Okay, I can pace to that. But, yeah, it's definitely the weirdest little things will just freak you out.
And so, I mean, especially if you're telling stories that are fairly dense, you know, I mean, like, not every comic book is going to be like Superman fighting Doomsday, where every page is like a splash panel, and you can lift one or two of those out, and you're still telling the exact same story. If your story's dense enough, you lose two pages, that's a lot of, potentially a lot of story information that you then have to find another home for.
Yeah, or like you lose your splash page, you know, and you kind of want, if you're going to have a big fight, for there to be like a splash page, and then you're trying to figure out, well, where do I have to cut, or how much can I cram in, and working with a new artist, like, it's been really interesting now, being able to work with a bunch of different artists, because you start to learn how to research artists so that you can write for them. Like, before Kelly Nicole Matthews and I started working on Toil and Trouble, like, I tried to go back and see what work they had online to be like, okay, so these are women that like to do farther away shots, and, you know, they like to they have really good body language, but, you know, maybe they don't, they have, like, a little bit more of a staged feel, so their characters aren't going to have, like, the whirling, blurry movement feeling like that. So you try and research your artists, and as you work with them, you get better and better at sort of picking up where their strengths are and playing to those strengths. You know, some artists can do 9 panels a page. Some artists, you know, 5 starts to look weird, so...
I think that's a little different, certainly, than animation, where you'll write the script, it gets boarded out, then sent most likely overseas to be animated, and then comes back, you know, months later, and you get to see the final kind of product there. This, working in comic books, you can have a much more interactive exchange with the artist. You can be much more of a collaborative experience.
Oh, yeah, that's the great thing about comics, is lots more control, lots less money.
Well, we are mentioning Toil and Trouble. That is one of the main reasons that Mark reads in here today, because it's the new collection of your series that came out here. Now, this was just, what I loved about this, so many things that I loved reading about this, was in the back where you kind of explain why you did this, is to make this, many people think of Shakespeare, and they're like, ugh, that guy. All right. That's language. Oh, boy. Oh, what am I doing? Yes. And for me, it's like, you know Shakespeare is, like, cool, and he's held in esteem, but it's like, oh, man, the language. And much like you said, that was like, for many people, just like that language just gets them. And finding a way to say, no, there's so many cool elements, get past the language and see everything that's within his text there. And so I figured this was what you wanted to achieve, like this hit me right in the sweet spot for this.
Yeah, well, first of all, if you don't like Shakespeare, know that you've probably watched a lot of bad Shakespeare. Like, the first thing is that, like, every, like, high school that does Shakespeare does it about half speed, you know? Like, everything is really slow and drawn out, and we're gazing into the distance, and it's like, oh my god.
Subtext is completely lost. Because, it's all very surface.
Exactly, because I treat it like Shakespeare, but really, he's like the Tom Clancy of his time. Like, it's supposed to be fast.
Well,
it's
also
funny.
The iambic, like, pentameter lends itself, there's a very specific rhythm and a tempo, and especially if you're watching, like you say, like a high school production, that goes out the window almost completely. But that tempo and that sense of pacing, that momentum that gets you in and out of scenes, in and out of exchanges, that really lets you, if it's performed well, you almost can, like, ride it. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
Or like you're listening to a piece of music, in a way.
Yeah, and, like, that was something that I was, like, because my family were huge Shakespeare nuts. Like, my dad, for, like, a couple of years, like, woke us up reading Shakespeare. I know.
It just sounds so magical.
Right?
It's much better than Lucretia got woken up with, like...
Like the Killing Joke.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Jesus.
But yeah, so like we were very comfortable with like the rhythm of Shakespeare's speech, and then you get to enjoy all the humor, like the Romeo and Juliet scene, like, do you bite your thumb at me? Oh, I bite my thumb, but not at you, sir. Like, that's hilarious. Like, if you're not laughing at that, someone's screwing something up. So yeah, so this was my chance to sort of go in and keep some semblance of the language. I did at one point consider, like, oh, can I write this on iambic pentameter? And the answer was no. But be able to, like, kind of give it what I think Bill might have wanted if he had had the unlimited production budget, you know? Because there's so many things, especially in Macbeth, where the characters walk in and they're like, whoa, some crazy shit just happened off stage. And we get to show all of that stuff.
Yeah. What I liked is we were talking about the origins of this whole story is it came when you had an assignment to just write something from a different perspective, and you decided to write just kind of one little thing about the witches. That was like an element of the story that just really intrigued you. You wanted to read what starts, what comes before Macbeth. And I thought that was an interesting way to just approach a story like that. If you're looking at it from a different perspective, just to do something entirely different. And so when you're going, how long did that initial idea, how long did like the witches and what they were there for, was that just from the first experience with this story that always kind of stuck with your head, or is it upon the subsequent rereadings, you're like, hey, what is with these witches?
Well, I mean, I was familiar with the play, and yeah, in college, I completely messed up a homework assignment because they were like, write a 5-page adaptation. But like, Wicked had just come out. So I was like, oh, they mean like write a completely new story that exists in this framework instead of just write it in the 1950s, which is what I should have done and what everyone else did. And
boring. You thought outside of the box. That's way better.
Yeah, well, thank God she didn't fail me for it. Really good. Thanks, Professor. But yeah, there's just something, because if you read the play of Macbeth, the witches kind of show up and they're like constantly and really actively just messing with everyone. And actually in a lot of productions, because the witches were minor cast members, they would have been recycled. So these people would have kept coming up on screen or not on stage, you know, like as other minor characters. So it really gave the sense that the witches are just super invested in messing with these people, but you have no idea why. Like, why does it matter to them? And so that just kind of always sort of stuck with me. And so, yeah, it took me, like, 10 years to figure out what was the matter. But but I finally did. And so I wanted to tell the story of these three sort of fates and the idea that that's what happens when one of you disagrees with what's supposed to happen next.
That's one thing I found really fascinating about this story is that a lot of versions of Macbeth that I've seen, the witches, yeah, there's always three of them, but for all intents and purposes, it seems a lot of the time like it's three heads on one entity, and there isn't really any difference in point of view between the three of them. So to see them all represented as sisters with their own points of view and their own ideas of like, when we don't have a clear king, who is it going to be? And watching their personalities play off of each other where I had not seen personalities exist before, I thought was really cool.
Yeah, well, they have some neat personalities because there's a whole speech that we actually kept in our book where like one of the witches talks about how like she goes to some lady's house and like the lady doesn't offer her anything to eat, you know, and then so she kills her husband, like, because that's
fair.
Yeah, but like you're right, they have this sort of sense of just being kind of like the shark in Jaws or like the Joker in Dark Knight, like kind of just inevitable. You don't know anything about them, but I really liked the idea that, you know, that we were going to play them as individual people that had their own points of view, and the only time they really come together is when they're sort of in a prophecy, like in like prophecy mode, and deciding like, oh, okay, this is definitely what's, you know, this is what we see. And but then you step back from it and it's like, well, what does that mean? I think it means this guy should be king. Well, I think it means this guy should be king. And then sort of like, how do you hash that out? And the answer is violently.
Yeah, with swords and like antlers and blood. I love it.
Yeah, and like a lot of grudges. And so I really like that. I really enjoy characters that have grudges and hold on to them.
Well, what I love is like these witches, they have access to worlds, and they have these abilities that are so far beyond the comprehension of regular people. But even within that, and you would assume based on the way I've seen them depicted, that they have this greater, if not a greater knowledge, than they are not susceptible to the same foibles as the rest of us. So to see that, like you say, like it's when they've got a prophecy and they go like, okay, we know what to do. Prophecy says this. Our direction is clear. We have our external guidance and we're fine. But in the absence of that external guidance, they fall into some of the same like petty squabbling from a place of emotion that people do, which I love that. And I love too that they have this very, very distinctly sister bond between the three of them, to watch that the personal investment come into this bigger struggle, I thought was really, really well seated, well weaved through.
And then these people is like jerseys, just to slip into people and be like, "We're duking it out, let's go." It was fascinating, and oh my gosh, those fight scenes were really cool to look at. It felt theatrical.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, we really tried to keep their magic kind of grounded in the sense of reality. Like, I didn't want to get into like a sort of like old school Doctor Strange, like we're just yelling stuff at each other and there's like lights happening. So like the witches, you know, they can disguise themselves, they turn into animals, but like they really don't push people that much. Like everything is just kind of little nudges like here and there to kind of just start to manipulate people. But no, I really liked the idea. Like in my mind, the prophecy disagreement that starts this whole thing is like the first time they've ever disagreed. And I think that sort of is a real spiraling effect. Like if you're someone who's used to literally knowing the future and knowing fate, then when the person you've been working next to for thousands of years is like, "Yep, it's really clear this guy should be king," and you're like, "Whoa, what? Like, no, this other guy should be king." Like that's a huge crushing deal. And so, yeah, so then you got to go to war over whether Macbeth should be king.
Well, when you have this initial idea for the story, and she's like, "This is a question that I'd like to answer." They kind of explore and open up and a William Shakespeare play. Is it exciting? Is it daunting? I mean, it took you 10 years for this. So how do you answer some of the questions that you have in your head? Like, what are the answers to these questions I'm trying to ask?
Well, it's definitely daunting because this is my first creator-owned project, and it's always sort of... There's something about being like, you know, who should use a rewrite is Shakespeare. I can do that. Whoa. Yeah, Shakespeare. So that was like kind of, I really wanted to make sure that I got everything right. And so like I have like a copy of Macbeth that like has like a million notes, and we were lining everything up to make sure that the play lined up perfectly with the book. And if it didn't, where, you know, how do we explain that? So I really wanted to make something that was, I didn't want to treat Shakespeare casually, if for no other reason than my dad would be really mad at me. But because I guarantee you my dad whipped out his copy of Macbeth and was like flipping through it as he read the book just
did
to make
sure.
Did
he find anything? What was his opinion of it when he came back after reading it?
He liked it. Well, I had consulted with him, so like to make sure. But no, he was very he approved of it, which is one of, I'm sure if he told me like, "Nope, you messed up Act 3," I would have been like, "Oh." Like, no. He did find an allusion to Hamlet that I didn't know I made, which was great. And then he was like, "Oh, I love that Hamlet allusion." And like any good writer, I was like, "Yep." Glad you picked up on that.
Pretty smart of me, right?
Yeah. But no, it was just too compelling a story not to write and to try and figure out how to tell it. And I think sort of the interesting thing was it became a story that was less and less about who was right and more about just how much damage are you willing to inflict to prove that you're right. And that sort of became really interesting for me, because so much of Macbeth is about like, is he going to become king? Is he not going to become king? And I was like, well, I can't convince people to wonder if that's going to happen, you know? Like, so I have to think of another sort of framework. And so using the witches and telling their story and trying to talk about, like, okay, if you have a schism between this group, how far are you willing to go to prove that you're morally above everyone else? It gave us just a nice benchmark, and it felt like a nicely morally ambiguous story to tell in a play that is very much not about moral ambiguity.
Mm. Now, for 10 years that you're talking about the research and getting this all lined up for this, the challenges of a creator-owned book is it's you also need to make a living as you're doing this stuff as well. So how do you juggle something that you're certainly passionate about, but with also the practicalities of just, I need to live, I need to provide, I need to just exist?
Well, yeah. Well, I think for the first thing is that I think there might be a misconception that I went home every night and wrote this and then just chucked it out. Like, it's really more like every 6 months I would sort of be like, man, bet I could do something with that again. And then I'd try for a few weeks and be like, nope, not yet. Like, and then I would try another way or another way. And I sort of the last 2 or 3 years was when we really started working in earnest. And I met up with a bunch of different artists and we tried a bunch of different things. And then there's a terrible curse on this play that followed us around as we were making the comic. So,
well, no, the original artist that you had to bow out due to medical reasons, correct?
Well, the original artist I had when I first started pitching the book had to bow out because of personal reasons, and then the second artist had to bow out because of personal reasons, and then the third artist had to bow out because of,
oh my goodness,
other personal reasons.
Wow. And then like Spinal Tap drummers.
Well, that was actually one of the when we got Kelly and Nicole, because by then, like, we'd already gotten to the point where we were approved and we were in production.
Oh my goodness.
And so we saw, we had looked at Kelly Nicole's artwork, and so we were like, okay, these are definitely the people we want. And one of the selling points, I was like, well, there's two of them. So one of them goes down. And I fully expected one of them not to make it through the book. And I was like, I love you both. If you have some kind of bunker, you know. And even then, like, in the, like, during, like, issue 3, while they were drawing issue 3, I remember getting an email from them that was like, hey, like, there's a storm and it's knocked out our power and we tried to get to the library, but then like a tree almost fell on our car and it was like, no, get out. Like, it became like a very like Final Destination thing.
Yeah.
But they were like, at one point they were driving to their mom's house for like her birthday, and they got caught in like a wildfire that had like closed down the freeway. And so,
oh my
I kept imagining that like they're just forever on the verge of death, like, because of this book.
Did you ever feel bad for inviting people into this cursed project?
Only when we found out that when the hard copies were shipping, it was on that train in Texas that hit another train head first.
Dude.
Wow.
I don't think the conductor made it. Like, and I was like, oh my God. Like, there, I had a moment where I was like, this curse has gone really far.
That's a real curse. That's crazy.
Yeah. But all our copies of the book were okay.
So the copy affecting all the various artists that were associated with the book, what about you? Did the curse affect you at all?
No,
you skated free on that one. Smooth sailing for me.
Yeah, it was pretty much. I mean, other than like, you know, just the usual mental anguish. I remember distinctly at one point having a dream about the curse and being like, "Why is this book so cursed?" And someone was like, "Well, you need it to be. You need making it to be as good a story as it is." and I was like, "No, we don't."
Did you do anything to try and actively ward it off? Like, I know in theater there's a big stigma around saying the name of the play. So they refer to it as the Scottish play, but if you say the name,
you can't do that when one of your characters is named.
Right. So, well, like, I know, like, there are
Scott.
There are different superstitions, right? Where, like, if you say the name in a theater, it's like you turn around 3 times and spit or something like that. So, is there a lot of like getting up and sitting down and spitting around your workspace?
It would have been just constant, and so I didn't do that. Looking back on it, I probably could have. but no, I mean, there was prayer. there is definitely some prayer, and because we also too are the person who brought us into RKO was Rebecca Taylor, and then like as we started writing, she left and went to DC, so we also had a transition on the editing team.
Oh my goodness!
As well, but yeah, no, it's just a lot of cringing and anxiety, which is my normal state, so that I was okay.
But how do you, when you keep being faced with setback after setback after setback, how do you stay, like, what keeps you going, like, yes, I'm still, despite what the universe is clearly trying to tell me, I am steadfastly committed to getting this out into the world. Like, what keeps you focused and committed during those times?
It's just a really good story.
Yeah.
I just really, and then it became like an aggression thing where it was like, fine, you want to take me on, universe? Let's do this. Like,
I love that.
So, no, I just, the more struggles we had, even to the point where, like, if you ask my editor, Whitney, like, at one point, she was like, I don't want to say this, but this book really is cursed. Like, I've never had so many just weird issues happen with a book. And I was like, I know, right? And she's, but just like every time one of those happened, we were like, no, we're going to do it. We're going to push onward.
I love that warrior spirit. Just got to get it done. Got to get out there. It was worth it. I mean, I'm glad it happened. I really enjoyed reading it. It was a lot of fun. And especially the last act, when they're like, oh my god, we're sisters. The hell are we doing? It's like, which could have been like a very silly moment, but felt so authentic. Just to be like, oh my god, we are so stupid. Okay, bring it together. Like, after almost destroying one another, like, to the brink of just no more. And then they got it together. I really enjoyed that kind of turn, because we don't get that in the Scottish play.
No, it's true. And it's kind of a weird, it's the weirdest happy ending ever. Like,
because you know, too, you know what happens immediately. Once the story ends and you close the book on the last issue, like, you know what's about to happen. And it's not super pleasant for anybody.
Well, and that was actually a weird thing, because, like, I was writing it, and it was my first creator-owned book, and my mom is a grammarian, so I was actually having her proofread, like, before we went to print, so she got to, like, see it a little early. And she got to, like, issue 3, and she's like, I want you to know that I really like this Macbeth guy, and I would be very upset if anything happened to him. And I was like, Mom, you know we follow the play. Like, you read the play. And she's like, I would be very upset if anything happened. So I was really, like, nervous about that. But yeah, you have to, like, set up different stakes. And then, yeah, like, if you, like, especially, like, Lady Macbeth's ending was, like, trying to pull that off is that like a happy ending? I guess without spoilers.
It was destructive to my soul.
It's the most messed up happy ending you could possibly have.
But, and also, the way that you were able to, by adding these very different colors to the story that we already know, you were able to take certain moments that, for me, like the murder of Duncan, which in the play, it's perfunctory, almost. Like, you know, and you know what happens. If you're familiar with the source material, it's like, yes, this is something that happens, needs to happen, so that we can get to the point in the story where, like, the trees are walking.
Yeah.
It felt like it actually registered to me as a massive gut punch in your story. This thing that I thought would you'd roll past, like, would be super perfunctory the way I've seen it in other versions. And I think it is so to your credit, and so it so speaks to the way that you were able to create these vibrant voices, vibrant personas, and create emotional stakes that tie so well into the original story that, like, when something like that happens, I'm like, oh, like, I knew this was coming. I shouldn't be surprised by this. And yet I'm sitting here like, I'm a mess. I have to put this down for a second. Just, like, look at my cat. You know what I mean? Like, so that I'm okay. And, like, that's really cool and very unexpected, especially in a story like this where, you know, if you're a big old nerd, you've probably seen 50 different versions of this story. To be able to find those big moments is very, very cool and not easy.
Thanks. Well, I mean, we definitely had a lot of help. I think partially because the my artists are just so good at creating really expressive, emotive characters, and, like, we try to sort of make them look not typical. So, like, our Macbeth is a lot younger and a lot hotter than normal.
So he's very dashing.
So yeah. He is, yeah. Well, he would have been, like, 30 or even slightly younger than that at that point in the play. And he would have been played that way originally. Like, now he's always played by, like, someone who's, like, 50. You know, no offense to Patrick Stewart, but, like, it's not like he's wandering around and you're like, oh,
You're right. It is. Like, it's always, like, a Patrick Stewart type, whereas in your story, I was like, this is the most Charlie Hunnamy Macbeth that I've ever seen.
Give me that world.
So yeah, like, everyone, like, has their own distinction, and the story is sort of just different enough that we get to mess with you. And there's always, you know, there's nothing worse than hope, you know? And so there's that sense of, like, you know what has to happen, but maybe, and...
Well, yeah, and the witches believe it so much that you're like, they got this. Even though, like, time and time again, it's proved, like, they're not 100% sure of anything, because they're kind of just people, too. But I, she was like, okay, it's done. And I was like, yeah. Oh, God! And just naive. And oh, gosh. It does really hit me. It's very well.
But I think the one nice thing, though, is that we were able to sort of give things a different context, so that even though, like, when Macbeth kills Duncan in the play, it feels really different when he kills, you know, he kind of kills him for a lot of different reasons in our book, you know, and you get a much different sense of what that means. So even though you know what's going to happen, what it means for him and, like, for everyone else sort of emotionally now has, like, very different stakes.
It also brings a lot of humanity to Lady Macbeth, who is usually, I always picture, like, the baddest bitch. Like, when I see Lady Macbeth, I'm like, screwed. Yes, get it. But it's very, like, evil witch kind of way, you know? But here, to get, like, this whole range of why she's kind of slipped into this madness, like, who can't identify with, like, the loss of a child is the worst thing that could possibly happen. Like, to see her kind of have to struggle with that and then finally get to a point of, like, oh, I'm just pissed and I will take down everyone. It just lent a lot of validity to her situation.
Yeah, yeah, it's funny. Like, she definitely is, like, people talk about Lady Macbeth, like, Ursula the Sea Witch, you know, mm-hmm. like as, and she really only has like there's one line in the entire play where Lady Macbeth mentions that she ever had a child. You know,
I was gonna say like I straight up forgotten it in a number of productions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, it's I always think it's the best throwaway line ever because it's if for people that don't remember, it's Lady Macbeth is talking to Macbeth and he is sort of committed to killing King Duncan and you know now he's kind of backing out and she's like, dude, like I've breastfed, but if I promise to beat that kid's head in, I'd do it, like because that's what happens when you make a promise. It's like the most backhanded
so
thing.
Awful. Like, awesome in the same time.
I know. Yes. Yeah, so, like that's her way of being like sort of like man up. You know, you promised. But that line. Just kind of opened that kind of became the key of the whole play. It's like, wait a minute, like Lady Macbeth has a kid, she doesn't have a kid, you know, and it just that was kind of the key to Toil and Trouble was finding out like wait, like what happened, you know, like clearly the kid is dead because no one mentions him and we never see him and you know Macbeth has this whole big thing about it. He's worried that he doesn't have an heir, you know, so that just kind of spiraled into this idea of like how awful must it be to lose a child and just be stuck from that, you know, and stuck in that. And like, yeah, like if I lost my kid and I lost him unjustly and then I wanted to watch the world burn, like that's a lot more interesting than just, I woke up and I was a bitch, so I decided to watch the world burn. Like, so that became like really important for us is exploring sort of the cause of all of this, sort of the thing of like, you know, in Star Wars, they're like, fear leads to anger, and anger leads to hate, and hate leads to the dark side. Like, so, like, we're trying to sort of, like, walk back to fear, you know?
That's so awesome. Star Wars references make me weepy recently. Well, I'm like, look at this thing. It's, like, working. It's doing the thing it should be out in the world. I'm wondering, I know we briefly talked about this, the new Macbeth movie that just came out.
The Fassbender version.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Okay, so two things. One, I'm curious as to where you landed on it, and second of all, they also use a lot of children in the production. Like, there are just kids, just like ghost children, just hanging out, like, on the backs of horses and around campfires that don't seem to get a lot of attention. And after hearing your kind of explanation, I'm trying to draw parallels, but I'm not. It confused me when I watched the movie. I'm like, who are all these kids and why?
Well, in that movie, it was actually funny because we were just wrapping up the last issue when the Fassbender version came to America, and so my editor and both my editors were like, oh, like we should go see it to, you know, like this will be like our cap off. It was great. And then like the first scene in the movie is the Macbeths at the funeral of their child, and we're like, oh shit, like please don't be too much like our story, please, please, please. Oh, okay, it's not. Oh, thank God. it's a very different movie than we did, and it's kind of weird to even try. Honestly, it's hard for me to even say if it's good because we just come off 6 months of working in Macbeth, so watching that movie was like I remembered enough of the lines to be watching it and being like, that scene got cut, that scene got moved, why did they move that scene, why is that line there, that line wasn't there, this is a, you know, so like it just completely, I was too close to it.
Sure.
But it was interesting because I think that that movie tried to do a lot to isolate Macbeth and really make you feel like this is all inevitable and he's being completely railroaded by fate, which was kind of fascinating because like our sort of story is all about no one's really railroaded. Anyone could turn away from this at any moment. You know, we could all turn this ship around if we really wanted to, like, and save us all, but we're not going to. So it was a nice like contrast to see. But they also got a lot of the historical details right, which I was very glad. And if you haven't seen it, the way they interpret the prophecy, I was totally kicking myself because I was like, oh man, such a freaking awesome way to interpret that.
And it's beautiful.
It's a gorgeous looking movie.
It is
beautiful,
yeah.
To look at.
Now with the three witches, you say here at the back of the book where it's like, oh, would you want to do another story about this? It's like, well, if I had another 10 years and I could do another trip for research purposes, and I had access to a huge library, I would. Since you've kind of put that here in the hardcover, is that idea? Do you think, oh, I still have that idea if I have the time? Would you want to explore these witches in another story?
I think that they have a very set story. I think that Smerte, Kate, and Riata, like, it's designed to be its own story, and I don't necessarily have any other... I don't necessarily feel the need to, you know, like, put them in the 1920s or anything like that and see what they would do after that. It's always really fascinating to me to find the untold stories in existing stories. I mean, I write comics for a living, so clearly, like, I'm like, you know, Spider-Man needs another story. Okay, what else have we got? But it's definitely something I wouldn't approach lightly, and there aren't a lot of... We got really lucky because Macbeth is, you know, also Shakespeare's shortest play. It's one of his most technically... you know, production value-wise, complicated plays, and so it was a place where there were a lot of Spartan sort of holes to fill. But it's always interesting. It's just it would be a huge challenge.
Also one other thing I loved in the back of the book there is it's almost like you feel like you could take this into a classroom, because you do, like, there in the back the back matter, you're asking questions that you could use to provoke a class discussion about things, and I thought that was really just an interesting way to, you like, use this as a companion to the original material.
Yeah, we really wanted to do that. We tried to design the book so that it could be used in conjunction with a high school level or a college level course, and, you know, or with a library. And we've had like a few college professors come to us and say that they really like the book, and it's a great other, you know, take on Macbeth. And that's sort of like, yes, awesome. Because I think it's a good way to help you sort of, you know, we designed the book that you never had to know anything about Macbeth. So if you read our book first and then go back and read Macbeth, I feel like it's a nice way of being like, oh, okay, I get what is happening, and also get this other, like, layer and viewpoint. And so that's always the most exciting thing for me. I really hope it does.
That's really, like, awesome.
Make it into that classroom.
How awesome that's got to be to know that just in high school classes or college classes around there, back in their rooms, they're going to have Shakespeare's Hamlet there and then Toil and Trouble right there next to it.
Yeah.
Not too bad.
And because I love the idea that it makes Shakespeare accessible, like, I am now that I've got this idea in my head, I'm now holding out hope that you just find it in you to do more of these. Because we do, like, on the one hand, being, like, all joking aside, I feel like we do need to continue to try and find new ways to make Shakespeare accessible to audiences that maybe are put off by the text at first. But now I'm also going, like, well, all right, how do we reach the broadest possible audience? Maybe, like, do another one where they fight Ultron. That'd be awesome. I would read that book. And then I'd be like, Ultron, I'm going to read every Shakespeare play that there is. And then I get through, like, Hamlet and Much Ado and Taming of the Shrew, and I go, like, there's no robots in this. It's pretty good, though.
You had a trivia question, so we can raffle off the book. Do you want to ask our audience the...
Oh, yeah. Okay. So our trivia question is, if you've actually read the play Macbeth or seen Macbeth, you know that Macduff overcomes the prophecy and is able to kill Macbeth because of a certain medical procedure. So what is the name, the modern day name of the medical procedure that allows Macduff to go around fate and kill Macbeth at the end of the play?
So you guys have a week. You can DM me on Twitter. You can hit us up in, just Twitter. Just do it on Twitter, guys. Hit me up, @JoelleMonique. First person to answer it right, or most creative answer if nobody gets it right, and we will give you guys a copy of Toil and Trouble.
Ooh, right here that I'm holding in my lovely hands, right there, like a spokesmodel. Right there.
Look at me. You'll get your copy and you'll go, Frank Moran's hands have been on this book.
Oh, yeah. Right, there you go. Hold it with plastic gloves then, folks. That's it. You don't want that. Marguerite, if they want to continue following you on social media, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Margaret Scott, and you can also find me on Tumblr at mscottwrites, and my website is mscottwriter.com, so pretty easy to find out there. And if you want to pick up more of my writing, you can also pick me up with my new Transformers ongoing series, which is called Transformers Till All Are One.
So awesome.
Oh, what a cool... I love what they're doing in the Transformers franchise. Just, man, just from what you would think when you saw the cartoons in the 80s to what they're doing now with the storytelling, so incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Book Exchange, but make sure you tweet Joelle so you can answer that question that Margaret said, so you can win this very copy that I'm holding in my hand there. Joelle, where can they find you if they want to answer that question or just ask you about anything?
Yeah, I'm everywhere at Joelle Monique. Follow me this week on the Twitter. I'll be at Toronto International Film Festival talking about the movie, seeing the sights. If you want to see something and you're curious about a movie, hit me up. Let me know.
I'm Lex Michael, all of our social media at The Lex Michael, and if you see things out in your own life that you want to talk about, hit me up and we can talk about those things. I like trees too.
But like that, that's what an tempting offer that is, everybody. You can follow me on Twitter at Happy Go Jackie. Here you go. Again, once again, Toil and Trouble. Margaret Scott is the author for this. Make sure you tweet Joelle Monique the answer to Margaret's question, and you could have this very own copy there. We'll see you next week here on the Comic Book Exchange. We're going to be breaking down a story arc from Lucifer, the new the second season of the Fox series will be debuting September 19th. We'll be talking about the first storyline, the first five issues of that, breaking it down. So we'll see you next week on the Comic Book Exchange here on Book Circle Online. Bye, everybody.
Bye. See ya.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO. Join the circle.